Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode features the phenomenal Kobe Benben chatting about No One Dies Yet, a genre-breaking novel from a powerful new African voice. 2019 is the year of the return. It has been exactly 400 years since the first slave ships left Ghana for America. Ghana has now opened its doors to black diasporans, encouraging them to return and get to know the land of their ancestors. Elton, Vincent, and Scott arrive from America to visit preserved sites from the transatlantic slave route and to explore the country's underground queer scene. Their activities are narrated by their two guides, Kobe, their guide to Accra's privileged circles, and Nana, the voice of tradition and religious peoples. The pair's tense relationship sets the tone for what becomes a shocking and unsettling tale of murder that is at times funny, at times erotic, yet always outspoken and iconoclastic. In this episode, Kobe Benben is in conversation with Letabo Mailula, an academic at law, society and politics commentator and a cultural production critic. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. Today I am sitting with Kobe Benben, the author of No One Dies Yet. My name is Letabo Mailula. I am a cultural production critic, and I'm also a lecturer at the University of Witwatersrand. So today in this podcast, what we're going to be doing is confronting Kobe for this brilliant, but really frustrating and in a good way book to read, right, Kobe? I haven't read a book that has frustrated and challenged me in so long. So yes, Kobe, I guess you can introduce yourself and introduce the book.
Yeah, Letabo, thank Letabo. Yes. You'd have to teach me as Ghanaians if you give us an opportunity, we'll butcher everything. But yeah, I am Kobe Benben. No One Dies Yet is my debut novel. I'd written so many times in the past before, and none of them seemed to interest publishers. But then I wrote this novel, and I knew that this is the novel that publishers would be interested in. So I love reading. I also love writing. I love books that do interesting things with language, all of that. So if it's challenging, if it's confronting, if it's frustrating,
yes,
you would find me there.
I'm just going to start off by, I usually write one-liners to encapsulate the book. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those books that I couldn't write a one-liner for. Mm-hmm. But this is what I said. I said, the story that observes the greed and insatiable thirst of colonial actors only for the writer to slit their throat.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So I want to get into the book. Toni Morrison talks about a book coming to you, right? Mm-hmm. So she says that Beloved came out of the water while she was sitting in her house looking upon the deck. I'm sure you know this story. So where did No One Dies Yet emerge from?
I'm going to be very honest in this podcast. A lot of the things experienced in No One Dies Yet are based on personal experience, just tweaked in a way that is more purposive, because real life is never as purposive as fiction. It's not, you can't turn the pages of my real life and be entertained. So I needed to write a novel. I needed to write a novel that represents my personal experience in a way that entertains people, but also a novel that critiques the year of return in general. In 2019, Ghana did this big tourism program called the Year of Return that marked 400 years since the first slave ships sailed away. So the whole rationale behind the Year of Return was to encourage African Americans and people of the Black diaspora to come back to visit their motherland.
Yeah.
So the ships went away and now they are returning.
Yes.
So they are supposed to explore their roots on this trip. But the African Americans, the three African Americans in my novel, are there to explore the underground queer scene.
Yeah.
So I would say a similar experience happened in real life. Okay. And I doctored it in order to tell this story. Yeah.
This book is incredibly cerebral while not abandoning visceral emotions. So what had influenced you to implement this style of writing? I mean, there's a piece in Kobe's narration of witnessing a homophobic attack that was moved to the other side of the page. So the left alignment created an illusion of reading the text upside down, which was an added layer of distress for me.
That is a beautiful interpretation. I feel like when you send a book out into the world, you don't know, you know, these multiple and everybody actually hopes for a reader like you. Okay. And if anybody could watch this podcast, I'm leaning in a very Drew Barrymore manner. And Letabo is not taking my hand, so I'm retracting it. I'm retracting it. I've always wanted to write something that has multiple layers, multiple interpretations. It made sense because this is a book with multiple issues. I'm so interested in books that like unravel many layers behind the characters. I wanted to write something that was also graphic and visceral because I am so drawn to that in fiction.
Okay.
I like descriptions that grab you by the balls or the most sensitive parts of your body.
Yeah.
So like this is a more inclusive podcast, so I have to make it more inclusive. So yeah, if you read No One Dies Yet, the initial reaction, because you open the first page, the title says No One Dies Yet, you open the first page and it says independence came and left, colonization left and came, Harry came and left, it was we who killed Harry.
Mm-hmm.
By those first words, you are just immersing yourself into a roller coaster of very visceral and very disturbing imagery. I love horror, so yeah. I just wanted to also incorporate that in this book. I did not know I was writing a thriller. I did not know I was writing even something that was going to be this graphic, because a lot of the times I wrote this book in paragraphs. I focused solely on the paragraphs before moving to something else. So every paragraph was an individual world. It was only when I was reading it cover to cover for the first time, when it was in proof, that I realized that, oh my God, what have I done? As a reader, I was, oh my God, what have I done?
Yeah. No, I think, so even hearing you and looking at you as you're reciting the first few lines of this from your head, it reminds me of there are two, and I know because you're a reader on Bookstagram, and we are crazy about the first sentence of the book, right? And for me, Toni Morrison, they killed the white girl first. And Tsitsi Tangarimba, when she said, I was not sorry when my brother died. And this also, I was just reading. I read this first page and I stopped and I called all of my friends and I said, I have to read this to you. And we all went crazy. Anyway, so.
I love that, actually. Yeah. That you, and No One Dies Here, in essence, is the kind of book that you discuss with your friends.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't read it in isolation.
No. I need someone to bear witness to my distress.
And now you have the author here.
Yes. So now I know I asked you off the mic. Would you describe Nana and Kobe as a dichotomy within the same frame? But I'm asking this as the adage states there's a thin line between love and hate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to both be walking that tightrope, but leaning in opposite directions.
The entire business of Nana and Kobe in their relationship is that I wanted to write two narrators with two diverse opinions. It wasn't until I finished that I realized that these two narrators could be the same people. They share similar perspectives, even though they've got different values. So you could say that in Nana and Kobe, is one human body.
Yes.
All of them merged together, just as you see in the cover.
Yeah.
There's one that represents the dark side and there's one that represents the good side. But it's done in such a way that most of the novel is told in the gray, in the side where these two characters merge. So both are bad, both are good, both are evil, both are disgusting. I wanted to tell a story where it felt like you cannot root for each narrator.
Yeah.
There was no narrator that wasn't writing as humor. So if you actually merge Nanara and Copy, they form this like interesting body of work, which I'm so happy that you figured out.
Yeah. I want to ask you this now. Okay, so I thought that Nana and Kobe were two personalities in one vessel, right? Mm-hmm. But that conclusion also confounded me because it required me to realize that our characters were complicit, and Scott and Alton and Vincent had to be there to bear witness to Dada's madness, right? But then this now brings me to a particular thing that was asked to Toni Morrison, right? In that, why are you so coy in this book? Nobody dies yet. Does anybody ever die? Was this real? Is it like when people ask Toni Morrison, what is Beloved? Is she a memory? Is she a ghost? Were you intentional in subverting our preoccupation with categorizing and clarity? And this was a question I was going to ask you later, but you've already pointed out that you really wanted to exist within that gray and not in this dichotomy. So, yes, I know I asked you a mouthful.
It's the thing is, unreliable narrators are so my jam.
Okay.
I want to write fiction where it's told from a point of view, but even the reader has the opportunity to doubt what's being told.
Okay.
So Nana and Kobe, even though they were the same person, even though they were different people,
yeah.
I wanted, and they are the ones that move the narrative. So these three African Americans are coming to Ghana during the Year of Return. Kobe wants to take them to the queer places. Nana wants to take them to the traditional places. Nana does not want the friends to chase after their queer intentions.
Yeah.
I wanted to create a narrative where it felt like in the entire story, you don't know who to believe and what is the truth. Because truth is very murky. And at the end of the day, if you're going to write a book that is focused on one truth and pitching one particular agenda,
yeah,
it makes for a very, I think, an uninteresting reading experience.
Yeah.
Fiction is not supposed to have all the answers. Fiction is supposed to be discussed in groups. It's supposed to be deduced. It's supposed to be, we are supposed to read fiction and feel like the real world makes no sense at all. And it does not.
Exactly.
And all the times we go into fiction thinking that we might have answers, or we might have, how do you call it, very tangible lessons that we can take into the real world.
Yeah.
But this book just sits in that gray area, and I love it for the characters. I want to reveal something that would be a plot that is only revealed to the reader on later reading. But I also don't want to reveal it. So I'm just going to summarize it.
Yeah.
No One Dies Yet. It's a novel about a novel being written.
Yes.
By someone who wants to get into publishing.
Yes.
That's basically No One Dies Yet. So it's a big publishing critique, more other than its issues being, you know, how do you call it? Its issues, other than the issues it brings forth, it's just this big publishing critique. That is the essence of the novel. But also, you get to realize that as you're reading, Kobe is a writer who loves thrillers, and he's always wanted to write a thriller, but he's telling the reader that before you get to the murder, I have more interesting things to tell.
Oh, yeah.
This is not a straightforward thriller. I'm more concerned about how publishing treats writers like me,
yes,
the kind of things I'm supposed to write, the kind of things Kobe is supposed to write to get published.
Yeah.
And he has to, you know, this dance of pandering and
yes,
writing the things he's interested in. Because at the end of the day, it's just, I don't know, it's a behemoth of a novel. I can't even compress it. That's why there's a part in, I think part three, that says that a lot of it is open to the reader's interpretation. Like this short epigraph before part three, I want a reader to take it and interpret it themselves. But then I've revealed this thing that, you know, complicates things. But No One Dies Yet is just for every reader. It's personal for every reader. People come to me with different ideas of what it is, and I'm like, you're right. I didn't see that when I was writing it, but now I see that.
Yes, yes. I guess it's also the thing of putting your art into the world and thinking it's one thing, and then someone else comes with a completely new interpretation, which can either enrage you or also, I don't know, something beautiful can be born from that, because now you're also looking at your work from a different lens, right?
Yes.
So Marlon James.
Oh, I love Marlon James.
I know. So Marlon James has been accused of his books being too vibrant. And he then expressed his contempt at being regarded as the so-called Tarantino of literature, which goes back to the pressures of consistently pandering, and there can only be one of us. You know, he spoke about his frustration of the one great American novel, right?
Yes.
And Kobe in the book and Kobe Benben are also speaking about, you know, the frustrations of pandering to, if I am from this period, then I have to write, obviously I have to write about slavery and this and that. Letabo, South Africa, obviously I must write a book about apartheid, you know? So back to this Tarantino of literature thing, Marlon James expresses contempt at that label, right? And then he retorts that his work is not, in fact, too violent, but Hollywood has sensitized us to violence because they have removed suffering from depictions of harm. This book, in the wrong hands, can be misrepresented as too violent.
Yes.
But I think why it will make people uncomfortable is because it encapsulates all dimensions of suffering. How did you carefully harness this narrative while still insisting on the humanization of people that we would regard as villains?
First of all, I love Marlon James. I read Book of Night Women, and I have never been able to read any slave narrative again, because it's changed how slave narratives move for me. I want to read works that are that visceral, that are that violent, because the thing is, writing in essence is capturing what's in real life and bringing it in on the page.
Yeah.
But in the process, there's still so much lost.
Yeah.
So the duty of the writer to capture lots of what's lost, and in that business of capturing was lots of what's lost, you end up with very, very, maybe watered down descriptions, or maybe very accurate descriptions. I think a lot of the times people confuse, you know, they see what's being depicted on the page, and they do not want to attribute it to what really happens in real life. Mm-hmm. See somebody being chased on the street, being lynched for being gay.
Yeah.
I want to slow it down. I want to juice it out slowly, that scene. I want to write every single iota of violence that I experienced, picture on the page. Because reading is such an emotive experience, readers can often depict that violence as, you know, they can often depict this sort of narrative as very violent, but in essence, it's just real life translated onto the page. It's nothing but that. And for readers who, you know, would read No One Dies Here and say it's violent, of course it's violent, but real life is indeed violent.
Yes.
You have all these, like before a movie goes into production, you know, the production house, before it goes into circulation, a production house has to sit down and, you know, dictate which parts of it could be edited, which parts of it could be, you know, polished in certain ways. But I'm so lucky to have an editor that was like, Kobe, do whatever you want. This, if this is the novel you want to write, then write it. Because it would be a lie, even in that ending scene where Kobe is rushing into the oncoming wave of violence.
Yes.
It would be wrong of me not to, in a sense, depict exactly what happens. I think a lot of the times writers are so, you know, stressed about protecting the reader. And I think for a lot of narratives, let's say for sexual violence and things, we can, you know, create spaces where we protect the reader from these things. But beyond that, like these, you know, acts of physical violence that are rendered in real, that happen in real life, all of them, like all these things, the writer, the duty of the writer is to say that I am going to depict exactly what happens in real life, because that's fiction, yeah, in essence. Like, we are seeing something happening in real life. It's happening. We are writing it in fiction. We are portraying it the way we want it. And that's, I think that's the only way in which writers can be better artists. Because I would never write a book that protects the reader from a violence that I've witnessed. You should read it and know that this is what goes on in my world.
Mm-hmm. What does Toni Morrison say? I insist on being shocked. That's how we keep our humanity, exactly, actually. And even in this idea of violence and suffering, I think it's really important for people to understand that there are certain actions that, if it, there doesn't have to be blood and gore for it to be considered violent. And I think that you can see the suffering here when you kind of contrast the way that Elton versus Vincent versus Scott experience this this journey of coming back home, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
But now I want to get into this theme of neo-imperialism and cultural hegemony by way of African-Americans, Black Americans, and the behavior towards the Africans, right? In a way, there's this voyeuristic function. And in South Africa, you experience this quite a lot. I tend to not be in art spaces in Cape Town for a particular reason. The reason is most of the times when the artist makes themselves the subject and it's a Black woman, it just feels uncomfortable. There's this voyeuristic gaze and this kind of exceptionalism of German or Italian or whoever is living now in the digital nomad fiasco that is happening in Cape Town. And they try to extract themselves as if they're not taking part in that violence, right? So now when we look at the behaviors of Elton and Vincent and Scott, and coming back to cultural hegemony by way of African Americans, but then there's this guise that they're coming back to their roots and they're simultaneously still invested in perpetuating this chasm, which is us versus them.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about this theme?
I think a lot of people are actually surprised to find out that No One Dies Here is just 10% queer.
Yes.
Because I am so much very interested in the socialist like themes I portray in this book. The entire business of coming back to one's motherland, and in essence, that's what the Year of Return was. It painted this big fantasy idea, the fantasy Africa to this. If you read Jackie Kay, she says that, you know, people of the diaspora have this big fantasy Africa. They think Africa is, you know, something that it isn't. Africa is, you know, all the things that the West has even portrayed. The entire businesses, they are coming with their own perceptions, as you see with Scott and Vincent and Elton. But some of them are not willing to displace these perceptions. They come and they see what's on the ground and they think that I can still build my fantasy Africa in this land. There was this popular story. I think it happened in a place that's newly called Africa Town. Mm. It's Africa Town in a part of Accra where African Americans have descended on a town that has allegedly been sold by them to the chief of that land. But meanwhile, every real Ghanaian knows chiefs do not sell lands. They are just custodians of the lands and people own these lands. So then people come back and they are like, why are my lands being sold to these people? And it's been wrapped in this entire Year of Return package. Give them this, you know, the government to make like nice incentives for these people to settle, but it's just an opportunity to get their dollars. So these Africans go back and say, hey, we want our land back. And guess who have the guns now? The African Americans chasing these Ghanaians, yeah, like, we bought the land from the chiefs. We own this land. Yeah. This is our land. And we are also building a space in which it's just African Americans in a town that they've called Africa Town. So we are perpetuating the entire business of colonization. But they don't see it as that because they think they are coming for what's rightfully theirs.
Ooh, yeah.
Like, we sold you guys to slavery. So they say, you guys sold us into slavery. We are just coming for what's ours and what is for our ancestors. But then you do the DNA test and, like, it's like, oh, you might be from Gambia. You might be from this part. You might be from this part. Why is that land in Africa Town important to you? And I was very, very interested about these things. The fact that the Year of Return has made the local a second-class citizen.
Yeah.
You read that Kobe says, like, in the first part during the art exhibition, he says that it's led to exorbitant budget cuts that has made him feel like he can't afford his city anymore. And the local reaction to this is depicted in how Nana and Kobe sees it. A lot of African Americans who actually read No One Dies, they do not like Kobe at all.
Okay. Understand.
They love Nana because he's embracing them and he's like saying, this is exactly, this is our culture, you are people.
He's compliant.
But Kobe is like, no, this is not the case. I should not feel like my town is being gentrified by a new race that is coming up in the country.
Yeah.
Like, if you read towards the end, and there's this big dystopian fantasy where now accents have become access. What accent you have gives you
access.
So I was more interested in that than this big queer narrative people expect of No One Dies Here. And I feel like a lot of the times, this is one of the reasons why the government usually uses, you know, queer oppression to hide from bad governance. So a lot of people have said, don't read No One Dies Here because it's a queer book. It's got all the sex scenes.
Yeah.
But this is a book that should be speaking to the masses.
Yeah.
Like, people should be angered by this.
Yeah.
The queerness in this should not divert from, you know, the issues that the main characters are interested in.
Yeah.
The entire business of new colonization. It's not just a black white thing.
Yeah.
It's not just a black white thing.
It's definitely not. And I'm just thinking now, there's a review that I read that I was very angry at because I felt so overprotective of this book and you, understandably, where they just don't understand what the need was for this dystopia in the epilogue. And for me, I thought that critique was so ridiculous because of my positionality in South Africa, right? I speak the way that I speak because I grew up privileged. I went to private schools, whatever, whatever. But the reality is, in most countries, the way that your accent sound actually garners you some power and accessibility to certain spaces, right? Before I open my mouth, then people are just like, oh, you're well-read, or you're well-spoken, or you're this, and people will treat you differently based on that. But then there's also a disdain from the other side of, you know, thinking that you're better than someone else and this and that. So I also feel like the critique that the dystopia is too far away from reality is absolutely false, because that is the reality that we're living in now. Right.
And in essence, it's not even a dystopia more than it is a reality.
Yes.
As you've said, the beautiful thing about No One Dies Yet is bringing all these arguments. And some people make the mistake of, you know, reading it just for one thing.
Yes.
They read the blurb and they are going in for one thing. They might be going for the murder. They might be going for the queerness. They might be going for anything. But even as a person, I am very, very interested in circumventing. I realize that this is something people are interested in, but I'm never going to give you what you are interested in. Even if I'm telling a story to my friends, the moment I realize the details that light up their eyes, I want to move on to something that, you know, will keep them in suspense.
Yes.
The entire business of the dystopian part, if you've not lived within our context, you are not going to get it. But even beyond living in our context, if you've not seen how accents bring access, you would not see this commentary at all.
Yeah.
Because it's also really layered what kind of accents gives you a certain thing you want. You come to South Africa, there's a white South African accent, but you know, all these foreigners come with these accents that make them get more things and it angers some, you know, white South Africans.
Yes.
Like, there's a way in which people can alter and twist. Let me give you an example because I like telling things in anecdotes.
Yeah.
There's this woman who is essentially Yaa in my novel.
Yeah.
Like, she realized that she can only get things in Ghana if she puts on an accent. Yes. This is a woman who's never been anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
She runs this holistic healing business. Let me say it broadly so I don't get any, you know.
Spill the tea, Kirby.
And when you listen to this woman's accent, it is very, it's very contemporary foreign. It's very cosmopolitan foreign. It's, it's like, and it gets so many people into their classes.
Yes.
Like, everybody is coming because she's used this accent to her privilege.
Mm.
There are so many holistic business owners in the business, but she has branded herself, rebranded herself actually, because most people saw her when she was not doing that to seeing her success now that she's doing that. And we know clearly that it's because of these rebranding. And I think in Africa, living in these contexts, something that African Americans are so smart to realize, that the moment they come here, they have to, they realize that this country or this continent, like Ghana, let me say Ghana, runs by connections. If you want to be the kind of African American that, you know, you, every African American has a person that drew them to come to Ghana. And this person might be on YouTube, so distanced from them, living a certain kind of life. When African Americans come to Ghana and they realize how difficult it is, they see that the only people thriving are people with government contracts.
Okay.
So they alter themselves in ways that gets them things fast. And even with the people who do more holistic businesses, they bring all these causes like on the benefits of purging your spiritual something from the capitalism of the world and all these like things that market themselves as return experts, repatriate experts, to sell this narrative that like I am in Africa and I have succeeded. I want you to also come to Africa and succeed. It's all just a play of accent. A lot of people are actually really realizing it than usual. A lot of MNCs are leaving Ghana. Jameson, you know Jameson, the drinking company, they left Ghana because Ghana is so hard. Like the dream that was sold to them is there's no dream.
Yeah.
It's just hard. And the only way to make it is to have government connections. So like, in this book, a lot of African Americans are becoming attuned to that fact. And I wanted to portray that in this novel.
Yeah. Nana is my op, right? I found him to be so infuriating, but I also felt so much empathy for him.
Mm-hmm.
Because and you didn't touch on it as deeply, but I recognize because I've done some work on epistemicide and queer people, right? And Nana's pastor is misusing the word to kind of sexually traffic Nana on one hand to make money for the church. But on the other hand, it's also like, no, but don't go too far into that LGBTIQ plus myth.
Yes.
Because men are not supposed to do this with other men. So it's watching Nana revere being the tour guide and wanting to protect Elton and Vincent and Scott, but also being visibly disgusted by the homoerotic relationships, and but at the same time, absolutely hating Kobe for it. So I just wanted to talk about Nana.
The thing about Nana is, Nana was a hard narrator to compete with. I've had so many people come to me and tell me, oh my God, Kobe, I love Nana. And I'm like, okay, go invite him for this interview, not me.
Yeah.
But I created him. He's my baby.
Yeah.
I love him despite his
whatever. Yeah.
Nana just represents the kind of Ghanaian that they make themselves available to the manipulations from their pastors, from their religion. In their mind, they see being holy or listening to the Bible, following that as, you know, the core of not just being Christian, the core of being Ghanaian.
Yes.
So the higher he is to Christ, the charismatic version of Christ that is presented by his pastor, the more Ghanaian he is. And in this, it comes with all these layers of masculinity, like men are not supposed to do this, men are not supposed to do that. All of that, those things, you know, taking from, you know, this business of colonization and how masculinity is perceived by Ghanaians now. These days, you mention the word gay and no one wants to be gay.
Yeah.
Like, even I think gay is more of a serious insult in Ghana than faggot.
Absolutely.
So Nana is, he's doing all the things that his pastor says because it's going to get him closer to Christ.
Yeah.
But he's repulsed by Kobe, who is taking his place in the friends' life and doing what he could not have done for the friends.
Yes.
You realize that in the beginning, there's this big narrative. You see, you are not even sure if Nana is queer or not.
Mm.
But you read to the end and you realize that this guy has leanings.
Mm.
He has desires. He has, he's human. And I, you, let me tell you something. I don't know any man on this earth who has not had ideas about how it feels like.
Absolutely.
To do what we do
proudly.
When I say what we do proudly, to do the gay thing.
Yeah.
They sometimes think about it and obsess over it, and it leads them to places that they might actually find themselves with a label of bi curious,
the
very brave ones. Every human has fantasized about what it feels like to be with another person of the same gender.
Yeah.
Like, even if fantasize is not the right word, fantasize takes it to the extreme. Maybe imagine.
Imagine, yeah.
And the fact that we have, like, human beings are not given the opportunity to explore that because of religion and this, we must stay within these boundaries. It's what's hurting Nana the most, because he has anal sex for the first time in this novel and he's completely taken by it. He's like, oh my God, is this happening?
Yes, yeah.
And anal sex is sex that is preached against by his pastor.
Yes. Mm.
So Nana's character is a beautifully complex character, and a lot of the times, it was just, and because he has most of the humor in the book for certain readers. Most readers read him and they say, oh my God, he's so funnier than Kobe. I like reading his narrative than Kobe because Kobe is more, you know, avant-garde, journalistic piece writer. And Nana is just like, you know, quintessential Ghanaian telling his story. But at the end of the day, I wanted to write this character. I hated it when writers did that village voice and not have, you know, any connection to this character. I'm so happy. I'm not happy about my upbringing. I'm not going to say this. I'm not happy about the privilege that I didn't have growing up.
Yeah.
But it put me in certain spaces where I could have access to characters like Nana.
Mm.
And I'm so happy that I was able to give him that kind of complexity.
Yes.
That made readers even love him more than Kobe. A lot of readers, I think it's for a certain kind of reader loves Nana more than Kobe and you are not that reader. And that's okay. I'm happy you're not that
reader. Yeah, no, I don't like that at all. So I want to close it off, I suppose, quite romantically, that we actually had our first interaction on Insta, on Bookstagram. So I just want to close it off with Bookstagram.
Okay.
And Kobe as well. I love how you wove contemporary reality of Bookstagram into the book, right? And how did your online interactions influence you as Kobe, our author, and Kobe, our central character?
The thing is, you read all these books. There are so many sections of Bookstagram. Beyond genre lines, there are people who read, who want to read a certain kind of fiction that has a certain language, that's doing interesting things in language. And there are people just that want to read chill books. Yeah. That's fine. All those sections are, you know, valid to the big community. But I've existed in a community that prioritizes the beauty of language, yeah, how fiction can be layered with multiple narratives, multiple themes. And I'm so proud of that gang. So I pitched them in this book. I wanted to show my side of Instagram, which is not the entire business of Instagram. That issue of, you know, even just posting a post online and having a bigger, you know, content to repost, Bookstagram taking it and using the idea and getting, you know, more interactions than you. So in essence, that's exactly the kind of Bookstagram I come from. How irritating it is to see, you know, the people who have big fantasy accounts and big account following getting all the proofs that you would have done justice to reviewing. Most of them do not even review the books. They just flash it on their IG. I think it's also, you know, how fun this is and how funny sometimes we look at the community. I just wanted to portray all of that in there. I could not have done it. I could not have done Kobe justice without talking about that part of Instagram. It's also, you know, this business of course in the book, it's portrayed this big business of meeting people, making friends with people online that you might never meet in real life, that have so much impact on your life. You love them even maybe so much more than you know these characters in your life, because it's like the walls of beyond proximity, the walls of boundaries are thrown away, and there's a stronger emotional connection that you have with your Bookstagram friends sometimes even than your real life people. Sometimes you share so much more on your Instagram than you do in real life. Because of that, like, I've made it a point that my real life friends don't follow my Instagram. Because I love the community I'm building. I love these friends from different cultures and different spaces that you might never meet in real life, but you love so dearly. And this book is actually really dedicated to one of these Bookstagrammers who encouraged me so much to write, and that my time is coming in. One time a publisher would see my work and be interested in it, because I was always of the notion that so many books have been written and so many books have been hated. I also deserve to have my book hated. I wanted to come out so that other people would hate it too, because I too deserve to be published. If they have gotten published too, I too deserve to be published. And this big character in No One Dies, it encouraged me. She is dead now, and I absolutely wanted to dedicate this book to her. She's called A Special Kind of Double. I absolutely love her completely. Without her, I will probably not have continued pitching and sending my books to agents to read. So in essence, you read IG, sometimes you even write a review of a book and people might comment, oh my God, are you a writer? All these things, the community fostered this book. So I could not have written this book without including all of that.
So just to wrap up, I just want to give you the highest compliment that I think exists. Kobe, This book was undoubtedly one of the most frustrating and confounding books I've read since I was 19 years old and I picked up Toni Morrison's Beloved for the first time. This is an indictment on your extraordinary talent, but it was also a beautiful challenge because I haven't been challenged by a book in this long. And this is extremely beautiful. And I just want to thank you for your gift and your talent.
But it's also the fact that I knew a long time ago that you loved this book. I'm sorry you took so long to pick it up. But the girlies that I look for
here
are in this room. And I'm so happy you loved it. It's always, you know, a joy when people who share the same taste in books love your book as well. So thank you so much for these words. And I can't wait for the future, what is in store for Kobe Benben. And even on this podcast, if there's any person listening to this that has writing dreams, and it would happen. It took me 7 years before this novel came out. It would really happen if this is something, because the rejections come every day. Mm. But I'm so happy it led me to this book. I'm so happy this is my debut. I couldn't have wished for a better book. And to have, you know, you come on this podcast and say all these nice things, that have all these interesting interpretations of it that I never saw. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kirby.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.